so anticlimactic, there isn't really much to talk about except to say it happened.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is January 31st, 2019, and this is episode 123. Politicoast is a BC politics podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving us a review or get at us on social media. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott Glenboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, the Nanaimo by-election, more follow-up on Plekis and on China, and a couple other quick takes. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. First up, the Nanaimo by-election was not a surprise, was it?
Not at all. It's been a safe NDP seat for quite a while, and, well, that trend continued.
Yeah, the results came in about 9 o'clock last night after polls closed at 8. By 9:30, it was pretty clear that it was a very safe Sheila Malcolmson win. I think the first couple polls that came in did put Tony Harris in the lead.
I think at one point he was at 50%.
And people were like, oh, is it going to go back and forth all night? And it did not. It was as boring as should have been expected. But you wouldn't have known that if you were following one Main Street Polling's riding level polls.
Yeah, they put out a poll the other week that had the Liberals in the lead.
And that followed one that suggested it was like a very tight, close race.
Yeah. Now, the Liberals themselves were pretty quick to say, we don't think this poll's accurate. And, you know, part of that is, you know, you always want to campaign as if you're behind. So, you know, you don't lure your supporters into a false sense of security and whatnot. And part of it, too, was there was no signs that it was going to be a Liberal sweep.
And that precludes a bunch of mocking, I guess, on Twitter this morning of Main Street's polling record, because this follows their disastrous attempt to poll the Calgary municipal election. I think that's a bit harsh because they have had some other decent victories in terms of polling, or at least gotten some shots a bit better. But riding level polling is very difficult because finding a representative sample of a very small municipal region of like 50,000 people in total is hard, unless you're going door to door. And even then, you're still going to miss a lot of people. So,
yeah, the one thing that several people picked up on was the under 35s in their polling sample was very, very small. And I think they multiplied by
eight
or somewhere between 4 to 8 times to weight it properly, which, you know, when you have that small a sample and you're multiplying it out, that can cause some funky things.
They found the like 3 or 4 under 30s who like the BC Conservatives. And so it suddenly looked like they were first or second among that age bracket, which is not even close to accurate. So when you're looking at polls, be very skeptical of the crosstabs. And the total results are sometimes okay, but even this one was still 10% off.
Yeah, and like the polling industry's had some ups and downs in recent years. Sometimes they've done good jobs, sometimes they haven't. And part of that is just it's harder to poll people these days. So, you know, we should always take these with a grain of salt. It was a little interesting in that there were a couple indications. Like, that Main Street poll wasn't the only one that suggested that it might be tighter than previous elections, even though it turned out not to be.
Yeah, the results, let's get through them. Sheila Malcolmson gets 10,538 votes, or 49.22% of the total votes. Tony Harris for the Liberals gets 8,665 votes, 40.5%. And then it's quite a gap before we get down to BC Greens' Michelle Ngay with 1,579 votes, or 7.4%. Justin Greenwood of the BC Conservatives gets 442 votes, just over 2%. And the Van Islanders churned out 100 people, which is 14 more than the Libertarians managed to get, both getting around just under 0.5%. So separatism is a bigger political force than libertarianism in Nanaimo by 14 people. I try not to look at the percent each got in a by-election because turnout can be so different than a general election. If we look at the raw votes, though, we see the Liberals actually polled almost every vote they got in last year's general election. Rather than the 8,900 they got in 2017, they're at 8,700, which is pretty impressive. The NDP, by comparison, dropped from 12,700 to 10,500, so they actually bled 2,000 votes. Now, that would be expected for a by-election where turnout's always going to be lower. But I think the real story here is the Greens, who dropped from 5,400 votes in the general election to 1,600 votes in this by-election. So where did those 4,000 people go?
Well, part of it is that with this by-election being so impactful with, you know, the, in theory, entire fate of the government riding on it, the incentive to vote strategically is much higher than when you're just one riding in 87 and, you know, your vote's a lot more dispersed that way. So there's an incentive there. Part of it is also, as a lot of people suggested, the junior partners in most power sharing agreements generally don't fare well because the senior partner gets all the credit for the good things and the junior partner gets blamed for going along with any of the bad things.
Well, and I think the BC Greens, people keep forgetting, took a lot of their vote from the BC Liberals. And that's potentially going back because during the election, it may have been more of a protest. Like, the Liberals are looking too corrupt. At least the Greens are talking about free market-y type things with some environmental conscience.
Although in this case, it's worth pointing out, this is one of their worst results as a percentage of the vote in several election cycles. So this isn't just coming down from a high of 2017. It's coming down from like the last two decades.
I think there is also less of an incentive for third-party voters to come out in a by-election. We're seeing this federally with all of the by-elections that have happened so far, which are pretty much Liberal-Conservative races, and the NDP votes across the country in those ridings have plummeted to, you know, single digits. But there's no real incentive for NDP voters in some of these ridings to actually come out if they don't stand a chance of getting victory. And then you also have the lackluster performance of Jagmeet Singh, which everyone's quick to point out. But I think it just suggests that this maybe, I think people are reading too much into it, though, that the Greens, I don't think, are gone. I think by-elections are just hard when you're not one of the default choices.
I think in general, people read too much into by-elections.
The one thing this does tell us, though, is that the government is not going to fall or have difficulty passing its throne speech or budget, assuming the Greens keep to the CASA agreement, which seems likely.
Yeah, I can't see much reason they would ditch. I mean, this past weekend, Weaver sent out a few tweets that were very critical of the NDP, I think. But even that seems to be just one of Weaver's Weaverisms.
His messaging goes so back and forth. One day he's ready to blow up the government. The next day he's talking about how much of a friendship he's developed with John Horgan over the last year and how surprising that was for him. And despite all of their differences, he's so happy to be working with them. I can't read the man.
Yeah, and he's been very vocally opposed to the speculation tax that he voted for. There are some contradictions within the Greens.
Across the aisle, though, the Liberals are starting to try to figure out what to do. Andrew Wilkinson held a press conference this morning that I saw some tweets reporting on. Richard Zussman says Wilkinson's gearing up for a possible election this year. You know, maybe the NDP looks at this and goes, we're in a good position, we don't need the Greens anymore. But Wilkinson also let out for some reason that there are multiple, at least three, MLAs in his own caucus who have told him they're not running again. He won't say who, though, but we could probably guess a couple. I would bet Rich Coleman.
I mean, that would be the smart thing for the Liberals if Rich Coleman didn't run again. There's a couple of those former ministers that it wouldn't be the worst idea if they were to retire and let the Liberals kind of refresh a bit.
Does get to be an issue, though, when you're so recently in government to then have, you know, what could be seen as an exodus. I mean, again, this is what Jagmeet Singh is facing as a difficulty, is when a number of your caucus members are saying, I don't know if I want to try again with this team. It suggests the team's kind of falling apart.
Yeah, in part. But like, also, it's, what, three people out of a caucus of over 40? Like, it's not, you know, running for the hills either.
We'll have to see. I imagine we'll start hearing about nominations very soon. But the other by-election coming up now, potentially, is Nanaimo Ladysmith, you have to say?
Yeah, so Sheila Malkinson was the Member of Parliament for Nanaimo Ladysmith. And we touched on this already, but it's worth refreshing that because she resigned more than 9 months away from the Fitz election, elections candidates basically say, no, you actually have to fill this seat. So there will be a by-election here, even though Sheila Melkinson tried to do it so there wouldn't be one, but I guess did her math badly. Elections Canada also notes that there is no limit on how long a by-election campaign can last for. So in theory, they could call it in July and just have like a 4-month by-election and then drop the writ and get swirled into the general.
That would probably be the smart thing to do. I don't know why we'd need another round.
Like, well, because the law says we have
to. Yeah, the law says we have to at least call one. And whether it gets held or not, like you say, is a different thing. You'll have to see candidates nominated for the general election there anyway. And so it would be a shocker if parties nominate someone for a by-election who don't then become their general election candidates, unless more pee tapes and stuff come out. Not like Trump pee tapes, but like peeing in sink tapes.
Yes.
Which is
one of the
thing.
Famous ones from the last general election.
That's your heritage moment. But Nanaimo Ladysmith also seems like a fairly safe NDP federal riding, unless their fortunes go really poorly. Which
it might, but generally, even when the NDP hasn't done well, they've held Nanaimo Ladysmith.
So we'll keep our eyes there after we finish seeing what happens in Burnaby South, Outremont, and York Simcoe.
Well, moving on to Twit Tates, couple small follow-ups to the Plekis report. Specifically, this past weekend, Plekis indicated that those staff members of the Ledge who were fired and forced to sign non-disclosure agreements, he may rescind those. And this comes after Mullen indicated that there could be up to 20 or more people had been fired.
Yeah, that's a lot of people. This is a Laurie Culbert story in the Vancouver Sun talking about people who raised concerns about wasteful spending, who were then possibly asked to leave or forced to leave, which, again, very problematic. But
I mean, it was bad enough when the Plekis report basically indicated there was one or two, but 20 is a lot.
The move to rescind these non-disclosure agreements is actually pretty significant. Everyone likes, I think, in corporate or different kind of worlds to force these on as a way to keep PR good, but they seem to kind of hurt everyone in the end.
Yeah, I would lose legitimate reasons for non-disclosure agreements, but it would seem to me that it would be just good as a general matter of law if workplace misconducts were non-disclosure agreements were generally not enforceable.
I could see that coming forward as a kind of new whistleblower protection bill that I imagine if the NDP are smart, they're already drafting and trying to make sure they can get through soon, both at least for legislature staff, but also perhaps for broader society, because it's not like the legislature is the only place where this kind of spending happens. It's just there it's more egregious because it's everyone's money as opposed to just some shareholders.
Well, I was also thinking like their Me Too stuff has NDAs have featured in those stories fairly regularly.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The other bit, we didn't actually touch on this last week, but it had already started to come up as a bit of a disagreement. When the LAMSI committee met and discussed Plekis's report, they decided, hey, we should bring an outside auditor in to look at all of these finances, thoroughly do the forensic audit Plekis wanted, and figure out what's going on. And everyone's like, great, that sounds like a good idea. Except our own auditor general, who said, hey, what about me? I'm here as an independent arm's length person who has held this government to account and the previous government to account on a number of overspendings. Why can't I do it? Do you not trust me? Is this a sign of the government not essentially having faith in my ability? Should I even have this job? Kind of threatening to quit if she doesn't get it.
Yeah, it's not a great thing to have happen. I mean, I definitely get the instinct of going fully independent because I think it just, even though they're so far has been no indication that there's any reason not to trust the Auditor General. It just gives it that, you know, extra punch of legitimacy.
Yeah, it's been a talking point of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. I think the BC Liberals sort of picked up on it as well. But Horgan, I think after he heard these comments from, I think it's Bellwether, the Auditor General said, I have total faith in her and I'm not going to tell LAMSI what to do, but I think she would do a good job at this, sort of hinting that's what they should do. So I'm wondering if at the next LAMC meeting we'll see this put out there that, hey, maybe we could have our Auditor General do it because she's here. Weird little internal politics of who should audit. In either case, it's going to be a long, drawn-out scandal as we go through receipts and reports and try to verify what else is coming. I think the other thing we're expecting very soon is the response from James and Lenz to LAMC, because I think they were given an early February deadline.
Yeah, I believe it's next week.
So we'll have that to report on next week, because we always need content. I've been in the middle of a move, so like my ability to keep up this last week has not been great. My internet was delayed by like 3 days, because the TELUS technicians got stuck on hold, which just seems like a waste of everyone's money, or theirs at least, but I have internet now, and so hopefully by next week I'll be informed. But speaking of other things to follow up on, China is still kind of a mess. At least China's not a mess, but our relationship is.
Well, China has their own problems.
Following John McCallum's bizarre comments that we talked about last week, he has now resigned.
Well, to flesh that out a little more, last week we talked about the comments to the Chinese language press that were happening in Ontario. Well, he stopped by Vancouver on Friday, the day after we recorded, and at a event out in Dunbar, one of the Vancouver Star Metro reporters, China Xu, was there. She asked some questions, and McCallum, on the record, said, yeah, it would be absolutely great if the U.S. could just drop this whole thing. And, well, he kind of got away with it once, but the second time was enough that Trudeau basically fired him.
Yeah, this was a very clear non-voluntary resignation.
Oh, yeah. They were making no effort to hide the fact that Trudeau had specifically asked for the resignation.
And I think in terms of Canada-China relations, that was necessary as a way to make sure Canada could send a signal that, no, he's not speaking as government policy. We actually want to follow rule of law. I guess that's more a signal to the U.S. that we're trying to be their ally and work on rule of law and not so much cave to Chinese pressure and give up this executive. It's all a mess because there's no good guy in this. I'm not a big fan of the idea of being very chummy with the Trump administration at this point, even though the U.S. is our traditional ally. I also don't think we should be...
I'd rather we be friendly with the U.S. than friendly with China.
This is not a good bargain, is my point. I'm not saying we should give in to either side, but regardless, despite McCallum's hopes and wishes before his resignation, the U.S. has proceeded to file the charges and start the formal extradition process. So we have that to look forward to over the coming months. I have no clue how long these things take.
Neither do I. Yeah, this past week, the U.S. Department of Justice announced they were charging Man Wenzhou as well as several other Huawei executives. They happen to be in China, so they're not getting extradited to the U.S., but the formal charges have been filed, so we can expect things to get moving here fairly soon, I guess.
And then Meng won't be able to stay in her west side of Vancouver house and, I guess, neighborhood, because the arrest process for wealthy individuals is very different than non-wealthy.
I think even non-wealthy individuals generally are released on
bail?
Yeah.
Fair enough.
With promises to appear. I think everyone's talked about how much of a mess this is, but I think it does show that the Liberals really don't have a great strategy for China. And I mean, there's been a long-term tendency within the Liberal Party, I think, to be overly nice or have an overly rosy view of China in general that doesn't always match the reality. And I think they're kind of discovering the limitations of that quite badly. And overall, I think Canada's probably going to have to reassess just how close we want to get with China. And, you know, whether or not the fact that there's now going to be a new superpower in East Asia and that's going to change a lot of geopolitics means we have to actually change our policies in a lot of ways.
I know it's in vogue to shit on Oppo, the Canada Land Politics podcast with
Justin Ling. A good episode this past week.
But yeah, their China episode I thought was pretty interesting just in terms of talking to diplomat and former foreign minister.
Industry minister James Moore.
It was weird hearing Justin Ling talk to James Moore in like such friendly terms, but it was informative, and they sort of talked about these different approaches where both Trudeaus now have taken the let's be friendly at first and then we have to get tougher, and Harper kind of took the let's be tough at first but then we have to get friendlier, and they kind of both reached the same equilibrium from different ends.
Yeah, I think in general the Conservatives have a more realistic assessment of China, warts and all. I mean, it's, and as pointed out in that episode, they took much more of a transactional approach, where I think the liberals tend to take what they see as a principled approach, which often tends to be a little more rose-colored glasses.
The thing that jumped out on me was just highlighting how bad Trudeau's foreign policy has been overall. Like, it's a lot of good optics in theory. I like the, you know...
Unless you count India.
Yeah, that optics was terrible. But the idea of, you know, holding Saudi Arabia to account for human rights abuses, except for the tanks we are still selling them. Sorry, light armored vehicles. Like, Saudi Arabia's been a mess. India was a mess. Now China's a mess. Are there countries we are getting along with? The U.S. became a mess, but that wasn't so much Trudeau's fault as the U.S. deciding to shoot itself in the foot in late 2016. For all Trudeau's promise of Canada's back on the international stage, I don't know that this is what he meant.
Well, I think part of it, too, is that they've always taken a very, I guess, applied principle, whether it's often more of a, you know, real politic aspect to foreign policy. I mean, it's often been said that countries don't have friends, they have interests, and I'm not sure the Trudeau government has ever really taken that to heart. I mean, I actually think Chrystia Freeland probably has, but like everybody else in the Trudeau sphere, I'm not sure really has. And the fact is that foreign policy is very transactional in a lot of cases, and the we're going to, you know, make a big stand and look, try and look good isn't necessarily how you actually get results.
Well, we'll, I guess, wait and see what the next country we screw up foreign relations with is. I'm betting the UK following a hard Brexit. But we'll see. Trudeau's also in the news, though, for a new task force, essentially, to combat fake news during the election. It's been a big part of the Liberals' improving democracy plank to try to tackle foreign interference and digital issues as it comes to election readiness. Even when they fell down on electoral reform, they always kind of highlighted this other element and this other plank of their policy. And now it's kind of come out that there are going to be a number of non-political appointments who are going to get together and monitor for foreign influence or the spread of fake news or something, and they will sound the alarm if it happens during the election. But they notably left out the chief electoral officer.
Yeah, so this is one of the many things they're setting up, and this one includes Clerk of the Privy Council, National Security Advisors, as well as the Deputy Ministers of Justice, Public Safety, and Global Affairs, which, if you need to leave out the actual elected people on this, that seems like a pretty good crew, minus, well, Elections Canada. So I'm really not sure what the thinking there was, and the NDPs point out that potential flaw.
And the other foreseeable issue with this entire thing is the inevitable, and it's already happened, conservative far-right response, which is, this is the government trying to pre-rig the election or set up a monitoring. They're clearly just going to try to censor the truth or whatever.
It's not necessarily an unreasonable concern. I mean, that the language might be a little hyperbolic, but yeah, the more the government controls the fine mechanisms of an election, the greater the risk that it could be used in a nefarious way.
A ministry of truth is not a good idea, you're saying?
Generally not.
No, I totally agree. Like, it's this weird balance of there's Russia, which has clearly got an interest in affecting elections around the world. China has hacked Canada a number of times. And you even have far-right disinformation campaigns and other disinformation campaigns domestically. But how do we combat those without, you know, infringing upon free speech, people's ability to use the internet privately or securely, and other civil liberties issues? I don't know what the solution is. I think getting a lot of different heads together is probably a good start. The omission of Elections Canada is bizarre, and I don't understand it, but maybe there's a reasoning for it. Maybe they wanted to keep it within government and keep out the independent arm that is set up to control our elections. But that raises more flags than anything.
Yeah, I'm not really sure on that particular aspect, but there's more to this package than just that. Additionally, they're setting up a task force that includes CSIS, RCMP, CSE, which is Communication Security Establishment, Global Affairs Canada, as part of the Security and Intelligent Threats to Election Task Force, which has a nice abbreviation of, not abbreviation, nice acronym of SITE. Additionally to that, they're also going to direct CSIS and CSE to help political parties manage their own security, which, you know, would be a good thing. If John Podesta had two-factor authentication on his Gmail account, there is a chance that Hillary might be president, or at least would have moved the odds more in that favor. Or, you know, also not using a Gmail account, although Gmail tends to be fairly... But
yeah.
Yeah, but this is like a good thing because political parties don't have that much money. And, you know, just with how the incentives are, if it comes down to can we pick up this seat or use the resources to improve our digital security systems, everyone knows they're going to choose the former. So directing some government resources towards this is a good thing.
Yeah. There's also a bit of outreach strategy plan. They want to work with social media to try to crack down on disinformation and enhance their transparency. Good luck. I don't feel like Facebook and Twitter are going to listen to the Canadian government if they're not even listening really to the American government, who a bunch of people who sound like they need help turning on their iPhone, trying to ask detailed questions about algorithms.
Oh, these are people who don't even know that Google doesn't make the iPhone. Like that was actually an exchange, and I think it was the Senate, might have been Congress, where someone was grilling a Google executive about their iPhone.
And then here in Canada, we also have a bit of a public awareness campaign, a $7 million to forward digital news and civic literacy programming, basically to just try to tell people, there's a lot of lies out there. Don't believe everything you read on the internet.
Especially if it comes to Main Street.
Apparently. Maybe this will make a difference. Maybe it'll be not enough. Maybe it'll go too far. I don't have good answers here, but... I'm not going to fault the government for trying, actually.
Yeah, the fact that this is something being seriously looked at is a good sign, because in general, Canada tends to not be all that proactive in dealing with major foreign threats. So good on them, I guess. But there's some potential that this might not work or could be complications. So I guess definitely strong participation march. We'll have to see what the final result is at the end of this.
Yeah.
And finally, the Supreme Court this morning released their ruling on whether or not energy companies have to pay for the environmental cleanup when they declare bankruptcy. So specifically this case, which was Redwater Energy, they declared bankruptcy and basically tried to pay their creditors first, I believe, rather than deal with the cleanup. And, you know, generally creditors get placed quite high in the who gets paid back first during bankruptcies. So this is kind of an interesting potential change to that policy. Or I guess there was a disagreement between some federal and provincial rules on this. So this is a clarifying ruling on that, but one that's probably good and makes sense from a general policy perspective. Yeah, we'll have to let the lawyers actually dig into this. And like I said, this was only released this morning, so we haven't really had a chance to look in depth at this yet. But potentially noteworthy, because environmental cleanup has been an ongoing issue.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, the specifics here was there was an Alberta law that said basically what the result of this was, that environmental cleanup has to take precedence instead of usually just paying off creditors. And because of that law, this company tried to fight it. And they said, we don't have any money to clean up, so we just want to pay our creditors and be done. And there was this conflict, in theory, between federal corporate law, I guess, and the provincial environmental law. And so it had to go to the courts to be like, whose law is better? And it gets to the Supreme Court. And in a 5-2 decision, they decide there's no conflict between these laws. You pay off the environment, then you pay off your creditors. It's fine. It'll all work out. Dissenting, of course, is Madam Justice Cote, who always writes a dissent because someone's got to. But joining her was Moldaver, who is usually on the more progressive side or would generally side with the majority, but I guess they decided to go together this time. I think the one thing that remains is there is some environmental groups are still a little bit skeptical. The Pembina Institute was pointing out that if a company goes bankrupt, it still might not even have the money to pay the environmental costs. And in that case, we're still kind of left with this company that did a bunch of environmental damage with a promise to clean it up that now has no money. And who's on the hook for this? Who's going to, you know, reclaim the land? Who's going to pick up all the oil and put it in a proper trash bin? And I don't think that question's resolved, because that's not really a judicial question. That's just a political question. The answer is the government, unfortunately. But I think they're trying to highlight that maybe some of these projects, if they don't have clear business case and a clear environmental case, should be held to a slightly higher scrutiny. But in Alberta especially, that's not going to happen. So at least we can hopefully stop some further damage by ensuring that companies are forced to clean their shit up when they make a mess of things.
And that has been Politos. Find links to everything we talked about at politos.ca. If you're a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe and let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Thanks for listening.
And thanks to Podstream, our possible new recording studio, for hosting us today.